From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, why the family whose son was killed and daughter lost a leg in the Boston Marathon bombing made a stunning front-page plea to drop the death penalty in the case.
But first, let's go outside. I'm here in Washington, D.C. today, which is, of course, home to the federal government. But this time of year, one of the biggest draws is nature. Cherry blossoms that surround the tidal basin next to the memorial to Thomas Jefferson. The National Park Service estimates that more than 1 million people gathered to see the cherry blossoms last Saturday. I stopped by yesterday to visit with the Secretary of the Interior, Sally Jewell. Our first stop was a new kiosk that Jewell is installing in national parks to allow visitors to video chat with visitors at other parks. She steps up to talk with some kids visiting the Martin Luther King Jr. National Historic Site in Atlanta.
Hi there. Who am I saying hi to?
Sierra
and what?
Nanai.
Are you coming to visit the park?
They came all the way from Connecticut.
Wow, from Connecticut?
The connection isn't great, but Jewell says the kiosks are crucial to getting young people interested in visiting the national parks.
What this is all about is using technology not to disconnect people from nature, but to connect them. So a little hard to hear the audio on that, but as we perfect technology, it's going to give us a chance to give people an experience, perhaps, with parks that they haven't seen before and maybe inspire them to get off the couch and out of in front of the screen and come out and visit.
Show them the parks that they don't know about or that they might visit in the future.
Inspire them to visit parks in the future. It's 407 units of the National Park Service, and people might think of the iconic national parks like the Grand Canyon or Yellowstone, but they don't realize that there's a national park that commemorates the life and the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King. You know, there's a national park right here, the National Mall, which is the nation's front yard, which really invites people to learn about our history and our culture. And of those 407 units, they tell all kinds of stories, and we want people to know about them.
So people are going to hear you say that and wonder, are people not going to the parks? Is there a problem? What's going on? Why do they need to educate everyone about the parks?
Well, there's no question we have great levels of visitation to the national parks, and we hit records in 2014. But when you look at our visitors, they aren't representative of the whole population of the U.S. We're underrepresented with minorities in our parks. They tend to be older visitors and not younger visitors. And younger visitors are really tied into technology, and using that technology to connect them to parks is a way where we hope to drive visitation that's more reflective of the American population.
Why do you think that is, that younger people aren't going to the parks as much?
Well, we're urbanizing as a population, and young people are really busy. Most of the time, they're spending time during their day being told what to do by an adult. In school, on a soccer field or a basketball court someplace, or maybe in a karate class or ballet classes, they are being given very little time to get outside and explore on their own. And so for many of them, by their parents' busy schedules and their busy schedules, they're just getting more and more disconnected from public lands and open spaces and parks and nature. And we want to be part of the solution to turn that around.
What do you say to people who don't like any technology in the parks? They're not going to be happy with this. They weren't happy when you put more cell towers in some of the national parks.
I would say that they make assumptions about how people are using technology that may not be accurate and up with the times. I have children. They've been digital natives themselves. And, I FaceTime with my new little grandson. And it's an opportunity to use technology to keep us connected as human beings. And so if you allow people to use their technology, something that they're really comfortable with, we think that it will engage them more in the space as opposed to disconnect them. I will tell you, I've heard many park rangers talk of the stories of having kids that are zoomed into their technology on a video game, and then pretty soon, the deeper they get into a park or the deeper they get on a paddling trip, the more they look up and realize what's going on around them, and then they use their devices for different purposes, like taking pictures and sending them to their friends on Snapchat or, you know, whatever they're using. So we want to embrace it.
Why do you have a problem bringing more minorities, as you say, into the national parks?
Well, I would say here in Washington, D.C., among the cherry blossoms, we welcome a broad diversity that's probably pretty reflective of the population of Washington, D.C. and the city broadly. But when you get to more remote national parks, many families have not had a tradition of going out taking long family vacations. They may live in urban areas. It's not been just part of how they've chosen to recreate. And yet, as we urbanize as a population and as we become more diverse, we will need advocates in the future. They will be sitting in the halls of Congress. They'll be on county councils and city councils and state legislatures, and they will be reflective of the population. So we need to make sure that our parks are relevant and welcoming and accessible to all Americans. And while maybe in Anacostia Park in Washington, D.C., and on the National Mall, we have broad diversity, that's not true across the country, and we believe we have some work to do to make sure that people recognize these are their parks.
Part of our conversation with the Secretary of the Interior, Sally Jewell, in front of the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, D.C. You can hear more at hereandnow.org.
Well, the family at the epicenter of the Boston Marathon bombing made a rare and powerful statement on the front page of the Boston Globe today. Their request, laid out in a huge headline, reads, "To end the anguish, drop the death penalty." Bill and Denise Richards' 8-year-old son Martin was killed in the bombing. Their daughter Jane lost a leg. Their older son Henry was traumatized. And their call to take the death penalty off the table comes at a powerful time. The 2-year anniversary of the bombing was this week. This year's marathon is Monday. On Tuesday, the jury that found the bomber, Jahar Tsarnaev, guilty begins determining if he should be put to death. Boston Globe reporter David Abel has spent time with the Richards. And David, they are intensely private, but remind our national listeners, they're also well known.
Indeed, they've become quiet symbols for the horror that we all experienced on the finish line. And Bill Richard gave very powerful testimony during the trial. That's why it makes the points that they made today on the front page of the Boston Globe that much more powerful.
And what is their reason for not wanting the death penalty?
Well, I think a lot of victims actually wanted this trial not even to happen. I think for the Richards, as well as many others, they want to just let that go. They want it to be done. And they would have probably been happy if there was some kind of plea agreement that came in advance of the trial. And now, essentially, that's what they're seeking. They're saying the conviction is done, the prosecution has done its work, and rather than prolonging a sentencing phase in which Jahar Tsarnaev might be able to tell his story and could potentially be on death row for many years with many appeals, they just want an agreement that would put him behind bars the rest of his life and forego any appeals and have it be done.
And this isn't, we want to be clear, this isn't them expressing their opinion on the death penalty. This is them saying, we don't want to go through this again. And to be reminded of the trial they just went through, they had to see, for instance, their little boy's clothing.
I can't even imagine what it was like for them to sit in that courtroom or for Bill Richard to have to testify in front of the young man who killed his son and caused so much havoc and horror to his family and to his community.
What has U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz said in response to this piece? It really rocketed around the city.
They have a duty to defend all of the victims, and it seems from their statements that they're going to press forward with seeking the death penalty.
And she, the U.S. Attorney, was quoted as saying that she respects the sentiments of all the victims, that all the victims' thoughts are important. And there are others who have expressed their opinion. The sister of Sean Collier, the MIT officer who was killed by the Tsarnaev brothers, she also said this week that she opposed the death penalty, and it's because she has publicly stated her opposition to the death penalty. She says, now that I've had a loved one killed more than ever. But while this is happening, what impact might this have on the jury? They've been instructed to not read the media.
Well, presumably they are following the judge's orders and they are not reading into this. I should say, though, that there are quite a few of the survivors that have insisted that they do want the death penalty.
Right.
And they have made that very clear to prosecutors.
For instance, there's Liz Norden. She has two sons, both lost a leg in the bombing. She wants the death penalty.
So it's a challenge for the prosecution, because there are mixed feelings.
And by the way, you underscored that the jury has been instructed not to read any media. It'd be very hard to even walk by a newsstand and not see this huge headline in your paper today, the plea to drop the death penalty. Did you have any concerns about that? Or?
Our job is to reflect the reality of what people are experiencing and feeling, and it's not our job to tell the jury what to do, and it's not our job to protect them from what is the reality out there.
And David, you've been close with many of the survivors. Are you surprised that they're starting to speak out? They have become friends. They've, you know, formed this community, and they've made a lot of decisions together. And now it sounds as if they're going to have different opinions. Are you surprised about that?
I think there have been a lot of mixed opinions from the very beginning about what should happen and how the prosecution should proceed. And I think these feelings are very individual and spring from very strong emotions, whether it's from religious faith, whether it's from personal history. And I think among the survivors, there is deep respect for the difference of opinions that people have on this subject.
Yeah. The Boston Globe's David Abel. David, thank you.
My pleasure.
And again, this year's Boston Marathon is Monday. The jury begins the sentencing phase in the Boston Marathon bombing case on Tuesday. You've probably seen a low-head dam, or at least the effect of one. They're those submerged walls of concrete that dam up pretty placid pools of water behind them. The water then runs over the wall, drops a few feet, and flows away downstream. It's beautiful and deadly. According to a report from Brigham Young University, 441 people have died because of the dam since the 1950s, but most of those deaths were in a spike in recent years. The AP's Scott McFetridge is in Des Moines, Iowa. So, Scott, tell us, where are these low-head dam drownings happening?
Well, the ones that they've recorded that they know about are a number of them in the Midwest, in Iowa, Minnesota, Illinois, and also Pennsylvania has a number of them as well. But they're all over the place, and no one tracks even how many dams there are, much less how many people die. So we know that it's more than 400, but there's a lot of unknowns with them.
Well, tell us more about these dams, and to try to picture them, they might be on a pool of water on a river next to a big old building that maybe used to be a mill, and now maybe it's an art gallery. But what did the dams do, and then why does that make them so dangerous?
Yeah, they were hydropower. A lot of them were hydropower dams, or I think that they had more simplistic, you know, older methods for the falling water, turning the mill wheels, that sort of thing. And they served their purpose. It's just that those factories are just long gone.
Well, and it's that falling water over the dam, churning and maybe turning a water wheel, that is the problem now. What is happening to people? Why are these deaths occurring?
Well, it really can be terrifying. I mean, sometimes people don't realize the danger and they go over these dams, or we've had some cases where kayakers get caught up in the flow. And once you go over these dams, even though it's a small drop, you get caught in this churning water. There's water coming down on top of you. It forces you down to the bottom. The way that they're built as a uniform concrete structure that's submerged, you go underwater and you really have no way to escape. Mm. And then once you bob up to the surface, it just forces you down again. And for rescuers, even they, if they get too close, they can get pulled in and they'll be in the same situation. So it really can be nightmarish.
Well, and the dams are also being used recently to keep lakes and ponds full, you know, behind them in times of drought. It's very pretty. People have homes along the backed up ponds. But we know that some states have been paying to remove the dams. So what are the impediments to removing the dams? Why not just take them out?
One of the biggest impediments is that there are just so many of them. A state like Iowa or Minnesota is aggressive, and Pennsylvania has been aggressive. But even if you remove 2, 3, 4, 5 of these a year, you still have hundreds of them that are left. And then a lot of communities, you know, they will say, you know, that they may realize that they're dangerous, but they'll know that there may be signage, and they know that if the dam's not there, instead of their home overlooking a placid, you know, beautiful stream, they'll look over what they think is, you know, a mud flat.
Yeah.
The people who want to remove them are quick to say, well, actually the free-flowing stream is healthier and better for wildlife, and it won't look terrible. But it's hard to convince people who really like their view right now.
Well, in fact, you spoke to Kevin Burns, mayor of Geneva, Illinois. A dozen people have died in the last 10 years at Geneva's Lowhead Dam. That's on the Fox River there. But he, the mayor, calls Lowhead Dams the third rail of river communities because people there love the way that backed up water looks.
Right. He was really, he's very thoughtful, and he realizes both sides of it. I mean, he sympathizes with those people who have really beautiful homes overlooking this water, and yet he knows how dangerous they are. That they had a death there of a kayaker just last year, and he wants it to be safe. but he also knows that his constituents have their argument, and they do know that although a lot of these are not well labeled, the ones along the river there, they are labeled. It's just that people make mistakes when they get too close.
But what about if you can't take them out and if the signs aren't working and beautiful water is tempting for people to go in? What about the suggestion of stringing, let's say, a cable from one side of a riverbank to another along the dam so at least you have something to hold on to?
Right, and there are those who do that. One here in Des Moines that actually I can see from my office window does that. Although part of the problem is when you're approaching them from upstream, you really can't see them. You know, that's why they're low-head dams. The water goes right over them. And so some people may approach them and not realize what they've gotten themselves into until they're too close to do anything about it.
And too late for a cable. Right. Well, something to be aware of. Scott McFetridge, the AP news editor for Iowa and Nebraska on low-head dams. Scott, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Robin.
Well, it's been a busy week in 2016 politics with both Hillary Clinton and Marco Rubio announcing they are joining the race, and their first weeks were very different. So let's get right to it.
Here and now,
2016.
Ron Elving is NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. He's giggling as we listen to that lovely sounder that we have for our 2016 segment. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Jeremy. I think that's the best part of the early start of the 2016.
Just listening to that. Well, much was made, of course, of Hillary Clinton's road trip to Iowa this week. And at a roundtable with college students, she sounded a lot like her online announcement video that was released last Sunday. Let's listen.
I'm running for president because I think that Americans and their families need a champion, and I want to be that champion. I want to stand up and fight for people so that they can not just get by, but they can get ahead and they can stay ahead.
Now, this is a different looking campaign than the one she ran in 2008 when she had her helicopter and she was bouncing around Iowa. Now she's trying to stay a little more low key. How did her first week go?
Her first week was successful from the standpoint of the campaign itself. They wanted to be as close to the ground as possible. They wanted to see her with regular Americans, everyday Americans is the term that they use, maybe shying away a little bit from the term ordinary Americans.
Or middle class.
She was popping up at a Chipotle. She was popping up at a gas station and taking selfies with these everyday Americans. And as many of these people seem to have been caught somewhat unawares. On the other hand, from the standpoint of many in the media, somewhat more jaundiced standpoint, perhaps, many of those ordinary Americans whom she was meeting appeared to have been, in some sense or another, pre-vetted or selected because, for example, in one town she was meeting with the mayor, she was meeting with the head of a group of local Democrats. So some of these people, while they certainly qualify as regular Iowans, as everyday Americans, they also seem to have been perhaps just a little bit cherry-picked.
Well, and she hasn't done any interviews with the media since she launched. She would have to probably talk about a few things that maybe she doesn't want to talk about, including why the Clinton Foundation, her husband's foundation, is going to continue to accept contributions from some foreign governments, why she hasn't responded to a request for information from Congress about whether she used a private email account as Secretary of State. How long is she going to be able to keep this campaign so controlled before she has to start answering some of those questions?
That's a question that's carefully monitored on a daily basis by the Clinton campaign. They want to be very careful not to wait too long to answer some of those questions, but they're not overeager to do it. And the demands for answers are coming at this stage of the game primarily from the media, from us. They're not coming so much from the people that she meets at a Chipotle. They're not coming so much from people that she meets when she arrives in Iowa. So if they become demands that are really rising up from the people she wants to identify herself with and be a champion for, then she's going to have to answer them. But she can probably avoid a lot of media exposure, or at least time it to her advantage for some while, yet most of the country isn't focusing on this.
We also heard this week the announcement from Senator Marco Rubio. He came out and said he's going to be running for president as well. He also spoke with NPR's Steve Inskeep just before his announcement speech on Monday, and he was asked if he's ready.
Clearly, if you see the history of the presidency, people that go into that office grow, the office helps you grow as well as you go through it. And that's having the ability to learn is a big part of the office as well. But I'm certainly capable from day one I'm very confident that I have the capability from day number one to lead this country.
How did Rubio do in his first week?
He had a good week. He's just 43. He's the youngest person in a very large field. But, you know, there's a real possibility that this week we saw half the people who will be on the national tickets. If Hillary Clinton winds up being the Democratic nominee, there's an excellent chance Marco Rubio will be either at the top or at the second half of his party ticket. Now, he's well back in the polls. He's still introducing himself to much of the country. But if Jeb Bush is not the Republican nominee, most any of the other prospects other than Marco Rubio would find Marco Rubio pretty irresistible for vice president, not only because of his youth and his Hispanic outreach, but because he might bring them Florida. Jeb Bush doesn't have to worry about that so much, but Marco Rubio has a natural advantage in Florida. So he had a good week. He addressed his youth question. He addressed many of the conservative issues that are going to help him in Iowa and New Hampshire.
You know, interestingly, we spoke with Congressman Trey Gowdy, a Republican from South Carolina, and I spoke with former Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott this week, asked them who they like for 2016. Both of them, the first person they said was Marco Rubio. So we will watch that campaign. One more question for you, Ron. What do these candidates need to be doing in these early states right now? If they head to Iowa or New Hampshire, obviously the big battle right now is for the donors, for the money. But what do they need to be doing?
Generating buzz. That's what they need to be doing. They need to get people talking about them in the states they're visiting. Every event they do, every hand they shake, they need to get people in conversation about them after they've left so that the media then pick up on that. And what reporters love to do at this early stage of the campaign is to say, well, whatever the polls show, whatever else you may know, however many dollars they're raising, it's people talking. They're talking about this guy.
NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving as we look ahead to 2016. Ron, great to see you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Congress has agreed to give President Obama the leeway he needs to complete a massive 12-nation trade deal with Asia. The Trans-Pacific Partnership would be the biggest trade pact since NAFTA was signed in the 1990s. Republicans say they will give President Obama fast-track authority to finish negotiations, which means Congress gets a vote on the final measure but has no authority to make changes to the deal. Bloomberg's Mike Regan joins us from New York with more on this. And Mike, remind us just how big this pact is and who's involved.
It is a very big pact, as you mentioned, sort of in the vein of NAFTA from the 1990s. What's notable is one of the big nations that's not involved, and that's China. But the nations that are involved include the U.S., Canada, and Mexico on this side of the Pacific, and Japan, Australia, and Malaysia in Asia, among other countries, of course. And the White House, their office of the U.S. Trade Representative, is basically pitching it as a way to make it easier to sell American-made goods overseas. And they're putting a lot of a focus on agriculture and farm goods. And they also see it as a way to negotiate sort of stricter labor and environmental rules among trading partners and curtail currency manipulation and also open the digital economies to more open exchange between these countries. So it's a pretty broad sweeping and very big pact.
But like NAFTA, it's got its opponents, and those are largely Democrats. Why are they against it to this degree? Republicans clearly wanted to negotiate with the president here because they want the deal to go through. But what are Democrats' arguments against it?
There's sort of a lot of pressure coming from labor unions like the AFL-CIO, and their argument is basically that it's going to benefit corporation and not workers. And they believe it could potentially actually lead to the outsourcing of jobs rather than creating jobs. So one of the things, obviously, the fast track element of it is one of the things that they don't like. They believe it basically allow the corporate agenda to seep into these trade deals without Congress having a way to counter that before they get a chance to vote on it. So it's definitely a hot button topic.
And President Obama cares deeply about this. This is something that he believes is going to be a big part of his legacy if he can get this deal put through. It's one of the things that he can get done with a Republican Congress.
Right. That's true. And, you know, obviously there are some concessions being made to try to get more Democrats on board. One, they included a human rights clause, which would be the first ever included in a trade pact like this. Also, the chance to allow service sector workers, not just manufacturing workers, access to aid that's meant for workers whose jobs are offshored. So, you know, there's still a lot of negotiating going on.
Mike, obviously, this is a political issue, and there are different sides that feel differently about it, as you've said. But would it be a net-net positive for the U.S. economy, at least right now?
It's, you know, it's very hard to say because, you know, what they've just negotiated is sort of the framework for which Obama can take a bill to Congress. What the details of the actual pact will look like, you know, are still to be hammered out. But again, that big elephant in the room is China. And some of the elements they're talking about, including, you know, the currency manipulation and human rights and an open internet, are things that, you know, China would most likely bristle at. So, you know, China really is the biggest trading partner, one of the biggest trading partners we have. So that's a big question mark looming over this.
And we will be watching. Mike Regan of Bloomberg News. Thank you.
We wanted to catch 29-year-old Sarah Uden before she leaves on the next leg of her journey because she's going to be gone for 4 months, and her entire journey has taken 4 years. She spent 150 days rowing between Japan and Alaska, 1,500 miles in a kayak paddling through the Aleutian Islands. She's pedaled 5,000 miles across the U.S. and Canada by bike. It's a modern-day expedition circling the globe with nothing but her own power. It's to raise money for 4 charities. We'll link them all at hereandnow.org. And it's also because she thinks she can. Sarah Uden is now preparing for her last leg, a 3,000-mile solo rowing trip across the Atlantic from Cape Cod to London, where her trip began in 2011. If, when she completes that 4-month trip, she'll be the first woman to ever do so. Sarah Uden joins us by Skype from Cape Cod. Sarah, 3,000 miles alone in the Atlantic. You've had to stop past trips. Are you nervous?
I mean, already on this journey, I've rowed across the North Pacific Ocean, spending 5 months at sea. And prior to that, in 2009, I spent 4 months rowing between Australia and Mauritius, totally alone on the Indian Ocean. So I'm no stranger to big miles and lots of days out in a little boat by myself.
When did this start for you, this idea of, you know, big physical endeavors alone?
I'd always been interested in the outdoors and really keen to get involved with kind of outdoor activities as a child, as a teenager, etc. When I was at university, I was rowing at Oxford University, and I heard about ocean rowing races, and I was just captivated by the idea. Up to that point, I had no idea that you could do such a thing, you know, take a small boat out across the ocean for months at a time. And so that was really my first goal after university, was to row across the Indian Ocean. And it took me 3 years to make that happen. And whilst I was out there, I just felt empowered by it, empowered by the idea that you could do something a little bit different from, quote unquote, the norm. You know, there's different ways of living. And I got back from the Indian Ocean in 2009 and very quickly set my sights on actually turning this into reality.
Well, when you are doing the rowing part in particular alone, either between Japan and Alaska or Australia and outer islands, isn't there ever a time when you're so alone that it gets either frightening or dispiriting? I mean, what are the bad days like?
It can certainly be frightening sometimes. When I encounter rough weather, I'm really limited in my ability to do anything really apart from strap down onto my bunk in the cabin and wait it out. And that can be really frightening. It's a small boat in often quite huge conditions, big waves. The biggest I've been through are probably 50 feet or more in 2012 on the North Pacific, which actually ended in my being rescued just after that system had passed through because my boat had sustained such damage that I couldn't carry on. So there's definitely scary moments. And they're the moments when I would like someone else to be there. You know, I'd want to share that with somebody. But otherwise, I think the ocean's all about just having as good an attitude as you can towards everything so that when stuff isn't going your way, you don't kind of get too bogged down in the fact that it's not going your way, because the fact is that things will change. You know, a storm cannot blow at you forever. So I think I've become quite good at knowing myself and being very self-aware and being quite good at bringing myself out of low points, or, you know, seeking someone else to help chat me out of it over the satellite phone, etc.
I was going to ask, what do you have with you? So a sat phone, and as you said, you've got a bunk carved out, but you're still rowing this thing, so it's got to be small enough for you to row.
It's a 21-foot boat. It reminds me of one of the life rafts that you get on the side of cruise ships. So if you think of it, something quite capsule-like. As I say, 21 feet long. It's about 5 feet at its widest point. It's quite low off the water, really. In the back cabin, which is my sleeping cabin, I can sit up, but if I sit too far forward, I'll hit my head. And it's obviously quite cozy in there. I liken it to sitting beneath the kitchen table, something like that. It's definitely quite a cozy setup.
Well, sure, which nobody would want to do for 4 months, sit beneath the kitchen table. So you have the sat phone, you have your rowing. What will we do?
I mean, the goal is to be self-sufficient out there. There's no support boat. There's no food drops or resupplies or anything like that. So my big job last week with my shore support manager, Tony, who'd come out to help me, was to divide up all the food that I'd need for that time and make sure I've got all the other supplies I might need, medical supplies, safety gear, different types of clothing for different weathers. So I've got a Kindle, so a big library on there, and then some real books as well, because if the Kindle breaks, that would be a bummer to lose all my books.
What are some of the books you'll take?
Well, do you know, the one I go back to the most, mostly as an audiobook, is Winnie the Pooh. And that really kind of links into your question about what do you think about as well, because that really is a whole spectrum of everything. At one end, it's being very Winnie the Pooh-like about things and just having an open mind that is not really thinking about anything, but then stuff can just wander in and out and perhaps it'll kind of take a few turns in there and you might think about something for a while and then another thought might float in. And then kind of varying degrees thereof, right down to the days when it's a struggle just to sit on the rowing seat. And, you know, I'm concentrating all my efforts on just making myself sit down and row and stay the course. Sometimes it's very technical. I'm making sure that I'm steering down the waves correctly and making sure that I'm not putting the boat in a position where we're going to capsize. Other times it's things like, what am I going to eat for my next snack? Or what am I going to say to my partner, Lucy, when I call her up tonight? Things like that. So it really can be all sorts of things. And I think my favorite days are very much the Winnie the Pooh days, when everything feels calm and content, very zen-like, really. And you almost go into a meditation.
The more it snows, tiddly-pum.
The colder it goes,
tiddly-pum. The more my nose, tiddly-pum. Well, so as we said, you are supporting four charities. But is someone else also supporting you? Are there corporations behind you? I mean, how do you do this?
It's a big, complex expedition in its ambition, I suppose. So I do have about 70 different partnerships with business organizations who sponsor my journey, and I've put everything that I've earned into it, taken out a bit of a loan, and been very generously supported by donations as well to help make the journey happen. So it is a big project to pull off, particularly after losing my first boat in the North Pacific in 2012 after a tropical storm. And then rerouting to Alaska on the following attempt across the Pacific. You know, all of those things have changed the journey quite a bit in its execution, but I'm really glad that I've had that support from businesses and sponsors to keep it moving and get me back to London.
Yeah. Well, Sarah Uten, we haven't even had time to talk about your 5,000-mile bike trip across the U.S. and Canada, but that's just a part of the 22,000-mile self-propelled trip she's taking around the world, and looking forward to a 3,000-mile solo rowing trip across the Atlantic from Cape Cod to London. It should take her about 4 months. Sarah, I hope we can in some way stay in touch with you.
We certainly can. The satellite phone means that we can repeat this from the middle of the ocean, if you like.
We promise not to call you every hour. See how you're doing. Best of luck to you.
Thanks very much, Robin.
Well, tomorrow night, eight performers and groups will be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, including Bill Withers.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away.
A great song, but often forgotten amid the music and the glitz, are the journalists who reviewed concerts and brought to life the behind-the-scenes lives of the musicians. Now, a grant from the state of Ohio is helping preserve some of that history. David C. Barnett from Here and Now contributing station WCPN in Cleveland reports on the legacy of a rock and roll journalism pioneer, plain dealer music writer Jane Scott.
On a cold and rainy February afternoon in 2005, Ohio University grad student Elizabeth Weinstein slowly approached the apartment of Jane Scott.
And I was really nervous. I'd been reading so much about her, and I was kind of intimidated.
The Boy and Girl column she started in 1958 would turn into a rock and roll beat that she covered for the Cleveland Plain Dealer for half a century, and by some accounts was the first person to do so, man or woman. But Weinstein says all her feelings of trepidation vanished when the 86-year-old Scott answered the door. It was like you were at Grandma's house.
And she served me some sort of custard pie and gave me orange juice because it was good for me. And one of the first things she said to me was, you know, please excuse the mess. I'm so sorry about this mess. And it was like her apartment was just this museum of rock and roll history.
That history was sent to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Library and Archives after Scott's death in 2011. Archivist Andy Leach says there's a lot to sort through.
We have about 40 boxes or so of Jane's materials, ranging from her notebooks, photos, correspondence, in addition to her record collection, book collection, magazine collection.
Many of these materials will be put online later this year. Then researchers can use the collection to get insights on different performers and to put dates on important events. In addition to that sort of hard documentation, there are many items that reveal the personal connections Scott developed with several generations of musicians.
So we have an autographed LP of Keith Richards, inscribed to Jane. It says, "Love, Keith." And there are photos of Jane with Bruce Springsteen and with Lyle Lovett and with David Bowie. Even some of the toughest figures in rock and roll, like Lou Reed and Iggy Pop, people like that, they all loved her.
I'm eclectic. I like Frank Zappa. I like Grateful Dead. I feel that I owe it to everyone to try to understand all types of music, even punk, which I don't really like, but some of it. And I give them a shot because I feel that it's part of the picture.
Jane Scott started her music writing career in her mid-40s, when she was more than twice as old as many of the acts that she covered. In this 1978 TV interview, she said she was always open to new musical ideas.
I probably would be very hard at my age to start if I had not kept up with music all through the years, but I never gave up.
Years before becoming her colleague at the Cleveland Plain Dealer in 1998, John Soder was a devotee of Scott's Friday magazine column and Sunday feature articles as a kid. And working with her on the music beat, Soder says he saw firsthand how Scott connected with her readers.
She didn't feel like her opinion was necessarily any more or less valid than the next person's, which is why she often interviewed other people at the shows and included their remarks in her reviews. That was, I guess we'd call it crowdsourcing today, but she was doing it before we used the term.
Jane Scott takes up an entire chapter in Elizabeth Weinstein's master's thesis, Out of the Shadows, Breaking the Gender Barrier in Rock Journalism. Weinstein thinks Scott needs to be brought out from behind those shadows.
She didn't just sit behind a typewriter and kind of come up with theories to make sense of rock and roll. She lived it. She wrote about her experiences. And often she wrote from the perspective of a fan or an audience member. And I think that she was relatable in a way that a lot of critics could only dream of.
Tomorrow night, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame will induct its 2015 class of performers. From the Paul Butterfield Blues Band of the 1960s through the present-day pop punk of Green Day, these diverse artists represent a mini history lesson in rock and roll. And Jane Scott saw it all. For Here and Now, I'm David C. Barnett in Cleveland.
And Robin, I'm in Washington. I want to thank a few of the people who've been so helpful to us while we've been broadcasting from here at the NPR headquarters. Thanks to our fantastic D.C. producer, Acacia Squires, our great intern, Ebony Joseph, and to Jill Ryan, who has been producing our coverage in New York and Washington all week.
Mm-hmm. We are always in good hands.
Here and Now, a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. Come home, Jeremy.
I'll be there.
This is Here and Now.